It's season two of the Carson McCullough Center's weekly We of Me. This is the second of two episodes based on our interview with novelist, essayist, editor, and former McCullough Center Writing Fellow, Melissa Pritchard-Schley.
This segment of the interview has been edited for time and content.
Tell me some more about your experience with Carson McCullers. Was that your first McCullers Ballad of the Sad Cafe, or do you remember what you read first and when that was?
It was, yes. I have to go back before teaching, but I want to go back to my experience as a student at a private high school, the Convent of the Sacred Heart, it was called. It was a girls' school, and it was on an estate behind these giant wrought iron gates. This is in Atherton, California, where I grew up in the Bay Area. And it was a very exclusive girls' school. And to this day, I don't know why my parents decided to send me there, but I think I wasn't doing very well in the public high school. I was terribly shy and my grades were bad and I was just floundering around. Somehow they put me in this school and I began to flourish. It was a convent run by Sacred Heart nuns who are highly educated, college educated, and it was a very rigorous program academically. You know, you took Latin, you took French, you wrote essay. I mean, it was a hard school to go to and I loved it. And apparently I had a gift for writing, at least the nuns told me I did, and I would win these little prizes. And I was like, really? So we read a lot. There was a lot of reading. And at one point we covered some Southern writers. And I remember reading Eudora Welty, you know, the three women, Eudora Welty, mm-hmm. Flannery O'Connor, and Carson McCullers. And first of all, I remember thinking their names were so unusual. And I thought, Flannery and Carson, those are kind of ungendered names. I love them. They don't have any, you know, I've never heard of such names. And then Eudora was like a great big cabbage rose name from an old-fashioned garden. And then I started reading their work, and I remember reading Carson, Ballad of the Sad Cafe, and just being blown away, because reading her for the first time, I remember being almost physically thrilled by the reading, because I thought, oh, you mean you can tell you can tell truths in stories. You can talk about the grotesque or the freakish or the inside room of me versus the outside world, you know, the gap between the inside room, she called it, I think, and the outside room. Everything was just resonating with me, what I read of hers. And it was startling and shocking and wonderful. The images were so unforgettable. And I've had some of the same experience reading Flannery O'Connor. Eudora, of course, is a little bit different, but basically that Southern fiction, sometimes they would label it Southern Gothic. I don't really go for labels, but sometimes we just use them to begin a conversation. So there was a bit of that. And that was when I first woke up to Southern fiction. And I want to say too, when I was that age, 14, 15, 16, I was convinced that I had been born in the wrong place and the wrong century. And I was convinced that I needed to go home to two places. And one was England in the 18th century and the other was the South in the 19th century. And I remember telling my parents at the dinner table that when I grew up, I was going home to England. And before I did that, I was going to move to the South, preferably Georgia, possibly Virginia. Had I ever been to any of these places? No. All I knew about them was from history books and a bit of literature. So where that came from, I have no idea. But when I was reading all the Southern writers, I just knew that there was something in that Southern writing that was me. And when I first started writing and publishing short stories when I lived in Chicago or Evanston, Illinois, and was camouflaged as a housewife and mother and writing secretly under the dining room table and beginning to publish, the journals that responded to my work, which was heavily influenced by the Southern writers, McCullers and O'Connor predominantly, and also the Russian writers, the realists, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Gogol, Chekhov, those were my other. They were the ones, the Southern journals were the ones who wrote back wonderful notes or accepted the stories and printed them. And I thought, you see, I knew I had something going on there with me in the South. So the fact, you know, winning the Flannery O'Connor Award after, and then getting the Carson McCullers Fellowship, I thought, oh, this is something. I just read last week, I reread Member of the Wedding. I had read it, I think, in the university. I don't remember. It was a long time ago. And I reread it now living in Columbus. I want to read it again. It's so good. It is so brilliant. You know, and I was, and Philip is of, you know, he's older than I am, and he grew up in, I think he's almost contemporary, not quite contemporary with Carson, but he was a little boy when she was, and I said, is this, and he loved Member of the Wedding. I said, is this how this Columbus was to you when you were growing up? Because he's told me a lot about his paper route and his father as a physician taking him in the car to the poorer parts of town to take care of people, you know, house calls. And he's told me a lot of fantastic stories. And I thought, this sounds like, and he said, yes, it was very much like that. The good and the not so good, you know, a lot of injustice and a lot of cruelty and a lot of things that shouldn't have gone on. But oh, I have to tell you one more story. All right. So when I was in Illinois and writing quietly and secretly my first book, Spirit Seizures, and I had published it and it won the award. And about some months later, I got a book in the mail from an editor at Houghton Mifflin, Betsy Lerner. I didn't know her. And it was just this book in the mail that was sent to me. And in it was a note from Betsy saying, you know, I really admired your book, Spirit Seizures, and your style and your sensibility really remind me of Carson McCullers. I think you'll like this book. And this is the book.
Wow. How about
I still
that?
Have it to this day. It's been a few decades.
Yeah. Tell our listeners the title of the book you're holding up for me.
Collected Stories of Carson McCullers, including The Member of the Wedding and The Ballad of the Sad Cafe. Introduction by Virginia Spencer Carr. And it was published by Houghton Mifflin. So it had just come out. She had read Spirit Seizures and thought, now, the comparison was wildly flattering. And I'm really not sure it wasn't false. I don't think I'm, you know, but I was wildly flattered. And I was also just validated in my feeling that I really do feel an affinity for these Southern women writers. There's something I really love about their.
What do you think is Carson McCullers' literary legacy?
I think it will change. It will continue to change as literary tastes change and evolve. You know, there are always trends and writers recede from public awareness and then they come back. They recede and come back. Like who's receded right now? I don't know. A lot of, I watch this sometimes.
Augusta Jane Evans has receded.
I don't know if she'll ever come back.
You never know.
You never know. Perhaps
that's right.
Something will happen and she'll be a sensation again.
That's right.
But there are these, you know, periods where you're eclipsed by other writers and then somebody comes out with something and they're rediscovered. And I think Carson, it depends. Some, you know, it's maybe a new biography about her, you know, spark something. I think you were mentioning one that's coming out and, you know, things will spark somebody's, the national conscious interest and they all start reading again. Mm-hmm. And I think her overall legacy, I think she's been, some people have pigeonholed her and saying that she's, I just read something about her calling her, it was kind of diminishing her. And I didn't like that. Calling her like a little bird on a branch.
Yeah, that's from the Regina Marler's review of Jen Chaplin's book. Yeah, the first paragraph, she says that, I can't remember the metaphor exactly, but she's basically saying that the other Southern writers, many of whom you've just mentioned, Flannery O'Connor, Eudora Welty, certainly William Faulkner, are higher up on the tree right now than Carson McCullers is. She doesn't occupy as big a space. I guess maybe that is true in a way. In another way, I'm not so sure it is. And I have been talking with a number of people in this podcast about how, you know, Carson McCullers may be the perfect writer for our time. And, you know, Sarah Schulman certainly thinks so and published an essay about that in The New Yorker a few years ago, that she's a writer that writers should be looking to as a way to write about people who are unlike yourself, right?
That's how I felt reading Member of the Wedding this past week. I thought she is so of this time. She is her honest grappling with gender and gender fluidity and, you know, issues of gender. And you could do a whole study on that. And there have been studies done on that. Mm-hmm. And her really literary confrontation of racial issues and injustices and of people outside of, you know, the two mutes, you know, I mean, she is brilliant for today, I think. Yeah. And it's funny because now Flannery O'Connor and are coming under some scrutiny, you know.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, this is, to me, is a really interesting sort of contrast. Jen Chaplin and I were talking about that, too, and she expressed her passion for the work of Flannery O'Connor, but what has come out about Flannery O'Connor's personal views gives her pause. And, you know, there's a brand new book about Faulkner by Michael Gora, Faulkner's Civil War. And it's a very good book. And, I mean, Michael Gora is a big admirer of Faulkner. And he says in the book that he thinks the three greatest American novels are Moby Dick, The Golden Bowl, and Absalom, Absalom. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't let Faulkner off the hook on the issue of race and his own personal views and so forth. So to me, this is interesting in that Carson was woke in the 1930s. Yeah.
I don't like the phrase ahead of her time. I don't like that phrase. But
it's true.
And she said things that no one else saw. She was an observer like no other. And when I first started reading Member of the Wedding, actually I went through and I read Ballad of the Sad Cafe again too. But the image that came to mind right away was someone dipping if you look at time as a sort of metaphorical river, and you go back to that time that she lived in, and you take a cup and you dip it in to Columbus in 1930 something, and you pour it out, and there that's Carson writing a complete portrait of that time. And she flinched at nothing. She flinched at nothing. The things she would say in her literature, she just confronts things.
Yeah.
But she does them with humor sometimes, with grotesque images, with this incredible honesty, saying, I was deeply moved when I read this. I thought she really reflects a lot of what's going on today. You know, this going back and looking at the consciousness or mindset of writers during the time in which they lived, of course they're going to have they're not going to be of this time. We're looking through our eyes and our perceptions and our wokeness, hopefully, back at people from a different era. So you kind of have to figure that in too a little bit. But I mean, Dr. Seuss is under attack right now.
It's true.
And you know, I guess it needs to be pointed out. We have to point it out, but then what do we do about it? But Carson is of today. I think people could read her work today, and it reflects on what's going on in very astute and interesting ways, and things she grappled with, and her loneliness and her sense of alienation and being outside. The Irish writer William Trevor used to say to be a writer, you had to be a powerful storyteller, fiction writer, you had to be on the outside. You couldn't be of the society, because then you wouldn't be able to observe it correctly. You have to be an outsider. You have to feel a bit freakish. You have to feel a bit.
Well, that's interesting. You should mention him. I don't know if you've ever seen this, but he wrote a little appreciation of Carson McCullers.
No, I have to read it because he's one of my favorite writers.
Oh, yeah. I love William Trevor. Great writer. And yeah, I was really happy to stumble across this. And I can't remember now what it was. It was a collection of critical pieces on Carson McCullers. And there it was, just like one paragraph. But he talks about his deep admiration for her work and what a great writer that he thought she was. Yeah. I ask you if you would read us a favorite passage from Carson McCullers. Have you chosen something you'd like to read?
Yes, I have, Nick. And some of the passages I might have chosen have already been read by your previous guests.
That's quite all right.
That's all right. So I kept looking, and it's not hard to find favorite passages. And the one that I've chosen to read now is from in the early pages of part two, Member of the Wedding, when she hasn't left for the wedding yet, but she's about to, and she's renamed herself because she's going to be a new person. So she goes from being Frankie to being F. Jasmine, and she's renamed herself. And again, this is, I love this part because it highlights her emphasis on the inside room, as she calls it, of herself, and the outside room. And there's a lot of that in Member of the Wedding. And we all have that, especially children have that in adolescence. And they don't maybe know how to describe it, how you have this inner world that is so rich and so full of dreams and what you're going to do with your life. It's infinite, the possibilities. And then what limitations can tighten and tighten around you until, you know, through society, the outside world. Mm-hmm. And so this is where she's come downstairs to see her father and in the morning, and she has some news for him. She dressed carefully that morning in her most grown and best, the pink organdy and put on lipstick and sweet serenade. Her father, a very early riser, was stirring in the kitchen when she went downstairs. "Good morning, Papa." Her father was Royal Quincy Adams, and he owned a jewelry store just off the main street of town. He answered her with a kind of grunt, for he was a grown person who liked to drink 3 cups of coffee before he started conversation for the day. He deserved a little peace and quiet before he put his nose down to the grindstone. F. Jasmine had heard him bungling about his room when once she waked up to drink water in the night, and his face was pale as cheese this morning. His eyes had a pink and ragged look. It was a morning when he despised a saucer because his cup would rattle against it and not fit, so he put his cup down on the table or stovetop until brown circles were left all over everywhere and flies settled in quiet rings. There was some sugar spilt on the floor, and each time his step made a gritty sound, his face shivered. This morning he wore a pair of saggy-kneed gray trousers and a blue shirt unfastened at the collar and with the tie loose. Since June, she had had this secret grudge against him that almost she did not admit. Since the night he'd asked her, who was this great big blunderbuss who still wanted to sleep with her old papa? But now she had this grudge no longer. All of a sudden, it seemed to F. Jasmine that she saw her father for the first time. And she did not see him only as he was at that 1 minute, but pictures of the old days swirled in her mind and crossed each other. Remembrance, changing and fast, made F. Jasmine stop very still and stand with her head cocked, watching him, both in the actual room and from somewhere inside her. But there were things that must be said, and when she spoke, her voice was not unnatural. "Papa, I think I ought to tell you now. I'm not coming back here after the wedding." Oh, he had ears to hear with, loose, large ears with lavender rims, but he did not listen. He was a widow man, for her mother had died the very day she was born, and as a widow man, set in his ways. Sometimes, especially in the early morning, he did not listen to things she said or new suggestions. So she sharpened her voice and chiseled the words into his head. "I have to buy a wedding dress and some wedding shoes and a pair of pink sheer stockings." He heard, and after a consideration, gave her a permission nod. The grits boiled slowly with blue, gluey bubbles, and as she set the table, she watched him and remembered. There were the winter mornings with frost flowers on the window panes and the roaring stove and the look of his brown, crusty hand as he leaned over her shoulder to help her with a hard part of the last-minute arithmetic that she was working at the table, his voice explaining. Blue, long spring evenings, she saw those also, and her father on the dark front porch with his feet propped on the banisters, drinking the frosted bottles of beer he had sent her to bring home from Finney's place. And she saw him bent over the workbench down at the store, dipping a tiny spring in gasoline, or whistling and peering with his round jeweler's glass into a watch. Remembrances came suddenly and swirled, each colored with its own season, and for the first time she looked back on all the 12 years of her life and thought of them from the distance as a whole. "Papa," she said, "I will write you letters." Now he walked the Donsdale kitchen like a person who has lost something but has forgotten what it is he has lost. Watching him, the old grudge was forgotten, and she felt sorry. He would miss her in the house all by himself when she was gone. He would be lonesome. She wanted to speak some sorry words and love her father, but just at that moment, he cleared his throat in the special way he used when he was going to lay down the law to her and said, "Will you please tell me what has become of the monkey wrench and screwdriver that were in my tool chest on the back porch?" "The monkey wrench and screwdriver." F. Jasmine stood with her shoulders hunched, her left foot drawn up to the calf of the right leg. I borrowed them, Papa. Where are they now? F. Jasmine considered. Over at the Wests. Now you pay attention and listen to me, her father said, holding the spoon that had been stirring the grits and shaking it to mark the words. If you don't have the sense and judgment to leave things alone, he stared at her in a long, threatening way and finished. You'll have to be taught. From now on, you walk the chalk line, or you'll have to be taught. He sniffed suddenly. Is that toast burning? It was still early in the morning when F. Jasmine left the house that day. The soft gray of the dawn had lightened, and the sky was the wet, pale blue of a watercolor sky just painted and not yet dried. There was a freshness in the bright air and cool dew on the burnt brown grass. From a backyard down the street, F. Jasmine could hear children's voices. She heard the calling voices of the neighborhood children who were trying to dig a swimming pool. They were all sizes and ages, members of nothing, and in the summers before, the old Frankie had been like leader or president of the swimming pool diggers in that part of town. But now that she was 12 years old, she knew in advance that though they would work and dig in various yards, not doubting to the very last the cool, clear swimming pool of water, it would all end in a big, wide ditch of shallow mud.
That's terrific. And that is one of the lesser celebrated passages, let's put it that way, and one in which we see more of Frankie's father. Yeah, I think, you know, when you think back on that novel, it's not he's a minor character, really.
Very minor, yeah.
But it's very interesting, that interaction between the two of them. And, you know, it's always just like Carson's own father, Frankie's father is a jeweler.
That drew me to it, and the fact that she's looking at him now as her new self who's leaving. And we all know that whenever you're about to leave somewhere, suddenly it all looks different. You feel a tenderness when you might have not, when before you just felt an irritation, and suddenly you're very tender. I think we've all been there. She describes it so beautifully. But if she had to stay, which she will have to stay, then she'll go back to the, you know, it's just when the love can come in when you feel you're about to lose that person or that thing. Tenderness can immerse and rise up and almost overwhelm you. And then I added in the last paragraph of her going outside and who she used to be with the neighborhood kids, the leader and the president of the swimming pool diggers. And now she's going to be wearing sheer pink stockings and lipstick and sweet serenade and a pink dress to the wedding and start a new life, you know, as F. Jasmine, which doesn't happen.
Well, thank you so much. That was a great reading.
You're welcome. Well, thank you so much. I'm really honored to have been on this wonderful podcast series, and I can't wait to hear the upcoming interviews of new people.
Well, thank you for doing it, and we really appreciate it, and I look forward to your new books when they come out. And so I know that you have, as we were discussing earlier, you have your path before you, so good luck with that.
Thank you very much. I'm excited about it, and poor Fanny will stay in a drawer for a while. I don't know. She'll marinate in there. I don't know.
Well, I'm sure she'll have her day.
She will have her day, yes.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Carson McCullough Center's weekly We of Me. If you enjoyed this episode, you can find more at mccullerscenter.org or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. This podcast was brought to you by Columbus State University's Carson McCullough Center for Writers and Musicians and by Columbus State University's recording studio. The music you heard during the intro and outro was written by Lilia Uge in honor of Carson McCullough's 100th birthday on February 19th, 2017. I'm Nick Williams, technical director for these podcasts, and I hope you have a great day. Melissa Pritchard Schley's reading from The Member of the Wedding is in the Library of America's The Collected Works of Carson McCullers. The music you heard during the readings was Movements 1 and 2 of Sonatina by Mario Castelnuovo Tedesco, performed by Terry Andrews Flute and Fred Springer Guitar, live in Legacy Hall on November 10th, 2019.